Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Levine v. Fang, Snell, and Krauss.
May it please the court, Mr. Roger Hughes will present argument to petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, this is not an attorney fee case about line drawing, but about whether Texas is going to continue to adhere to the majority and longstanding rule that the attorney figures his or her contingency on the net to the client, that is, the net after applying offsets, counterclaims, etc.
Let me ask you this. What if the jury verdict had been for the exact amount of the mortgage?
Well, that was one of the hypotheticals I was thinking about last night as I planned.
Sort of,
and I think the answer is, if they were right, as the Court of Appeals say, they still get money. Their theory is, and this is the theory that the Court of Appeals adopted, is that if there is a release of liability, a savings of indebtedness, that's part of the Levine's recovery, even if they don't actually get it.
But so it was a debt they were liable for, correct?
Say again?
They were liable for the mortgage, and if that were excused through the actions of the attorneys, isn't that the same as a recovery?
No. When they came, they weren't liable for the mortgage in the sense that it came up. They didn't become liable for the accelerated debt plus the attorney's fees, interest, and penalties until the lawyer advised them after he signed, quit paying the mortgage. The mortgage was paid up and current. So it only existed because the lawyer, after signing them up, said, now quit paying on that. That was what caused the indebtedness that was used against them and reduced theirs. And it's not a recovery because that's not how the language of the contract was drawn. I mean, they chose very standardized language, which under the authorities, the restatement, and I think Texas law, is that the recovery, and for purposes of calculating the contract, is cash in hand.
So your response to my question then is, if the jury had come back with the exact amount of the mortgage's damages, there would be no recovery by the attorneys?
There would be no recovery to the client, but under their construction of the fee agreement, Levines would owe the money.
But under your argument, the attorneys would get nothing in that instance.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's what most consumers expect.
An attorney would never take a case on contingency to cancel a mortgage today.
He could, or she could. That is permissible, but the contract would have to be specifically drawn, and I've given us an example of that in my brief, the Hootman case, where the client came to the attorney saying, I have a $400,000 mortgage on this property, and I'm the victim of fraud. And they specifically worked out in the fee agreement that if you walk away owing nothing and getting nothing, my contingent fee will be figured on the amount of how much I saved you off the $400,000 indebtedness. So that was built into the fee agreement. It is permissible.
Let me ask you, let's suppose that the facts of the case are that the plaintiff says, I've suffered deceptive trade practice damages here. And what it comes back, ultimately, it ends up with a judgment that cancels the indebtedness on the house. There's not a damage for the positive claim, but however it gets worked out, there's just a cancellation of the debt on the house. Is that a recovery of the plaintiff in the amount of the debt of the house?
Not under the majority rule. That is not treated as a recovery unless the contract specifically says so.
But there is an old statement out there that says a penny saved is a penny earned kind of thing. What can you read when there is an economic benefit, an economic recovery to the party, can you read a recovery to exclude if it's not actually paid in cash? In this case, as an example, the Levines receive $81,000 in cash plus a house. Now, do you read the house as not a recovery for the purposes of the attorney contract or not?
Well, they had the house before the litigation. They had title. The question was the forgiveness of the mortgage. And the mortgage wasn't accelerated until after the litigation began. And not only did they have to pay off the note early, they had to pay in, they had to sacrifice part of the actual out-of-pocket damages they were entitled to pay the other side's interest, pay their attorney's fees and the penalties under that because the mortgage was accelerated.
So what you do, you might have a malpractice claim, but the question is, what was the recovery? And recovery is a house without a debt on it. There's a house may have been $300,000 with $200,000 debt. They had one. Now they have a $300,000 house.
Well, that's from the client's point of view. That may not be quite what they wanted. They may not have wanted to have to pay it off, use their damages to pay it off early. That's not a recovery. I think the answer is twofold. First, they chose contract language specifically saying, I figure my one-third on the amount received from a recovery. And that language clearly contemplates a payment cash in hand, and that fits exactly with the restatement and the authority.
But doesn't that beg the question a bit? I mean, okay, let's say the next day they sell the house and they recover $200,000 with no mortgage against it. Isn't that a recovery?
No. And in fact, one of the cases they cite say the fact that the house might be sold later is not part of the recovery. The Mars case they cite in their brief, the lawyer actually tried to argue that after the collateral was seized through a foreclosure sale, the client was actually able to sell the collateral as a substantial profit, and that should be calculated in for determining whether the lawyer had performed and what kind of fee he was entitled to. And the court squarely said the fact that the client later on can use the collateral, sell it, make a profit, that's not part of the original contract. That's not part of the original language. I think there's a deeper policy reason here behind it.
Let me ask you, there's a couple of types of ambiguity to a contract. There's an ambiguity where the language in the contract is ambiguous, or there are provisions that are inconsistent with each other. And then there's the type of ambiguity where the language, when you read it, is not ambiguous, but when you attempt to apply it, it becomes ambiguous. Why wouldn't this be not the fact that the language is ambiguous, but why wouldn't this be ambiguous as applied? It says that any amount received as recovery, this contingent fee will be applied to. And so you go look at what was the any amount of recovery that's here. There's a $150,000 or $200,000 recovery. Part of that recovery, however, is paid to someone else, which is the lien holders on this house. And so there's a net of cash of $81,000. But when you try to apply, any recovery, you try and apply it here, you find out, wait a minute, there's two types of recovery. There's a property recovery and there's a cash recovery. Which recovery are we talking about?
Well,
do you have an ambiguity here because of this that requires the parties to go convince a court whose view of this recovery is the appropriate view?
Well, obviously we did argue that if the court gets past certain hurdles, there is a latent ambiguity, pretty much just as you described. But I think there are some hurdles that means that we don't have to get to that point. The first one is one of the rules of construction is the contract is construed against the drafter, and when the drafter chooses language that's been construed time and time before, then we don't have to worry about it. And I think in this case, they chose that language. And the restatement says so. The majority rule is the same, is that recovery means net after counterclaims and offsets. And if the lawyer wanted it to mean something else, if he wanted it to say, I can foresee it, then the lawyer should say, wait a minute, this means gross before, just like it did in the Hootman case. The second thing is that one of the things that you may consider in determining whether it's ambiguity is the circumstances at the time of execution. And at the time the parties signed the agreement, there was no counterclaim. The mortgage was current. No one was talking about defaulting on it and having them face an accelerated note, interest and attorney's fees. etc. But if you were to consider that as a circumstance, then the person in the place of the client would say, well, what is the recovery if they're an offset? Well, the law about offsets is real clear. The person does not recover the amount that is offset. The case law from this court and all the other courts addressed it, the person only recovers the net. The debts extinguish each other. So if the client had some knowledge of the law of offsets, the client would have said, recovery means recovery after offset, because that's all the law allows me. The law does not allow me to recover the amount that is offset. I only recover the part that is excess. And I think that's how you get, you don't have to get to
that's how you craft judgment. But the if I am relieved of a $100,000 payment obligation, that is a recovery to me.
Well, the under a law of offsets, both are extinguished, and the client may be relieved of having to pay an indebtedness, but the client is relieved because the client has to sacrifice their other damages. I mean, the client gives it up. And I realize that that might be a somewhat technical and legalistic argument to say, well, you're receiving a benefit. But I think what we're having a problem here is that the basic support for contingency fee contracts lies on two things that makes them publicly acceptable. And that is, first, the public has accepted contingency fees because it's simple and easy to figure out, and it makes them think the lawyer's on my side. His or her interests are the same as mine. If I make money, the lawyer makes money. If I don't get any money, the lawyer doesn't get any money. They don't go into it thinking that when this is over with, if I get no cash in hand, the lawyer still gets paid. Now, people who hire lawyers on an hourly rate or a flat fee understand, if I don't get money, the lawyer still gets paid.
Well, surely they understand if they get a free house, they're going to have to pay something back.
Well, they didn't go into it looking at that we want a free house. They didn't get it free. They paid for it with their own with the money. It was extinguished. And what went to extinguish it was money that should have gone in their pocket.
No, it was money that they recovered. I mean, that their recovery was $200,000, and they paid the mortgage off with those funds that were captured by the lawyer. I mean,
well, again, if you look at it from the point of view of the client reading that with some knowledge of offset law would have told them, you don't get that money. It's just extinguished. Your recovery is only, in other words, to determine what your recovery is, your recovery is only what is the excess. And if the client had looked at offset law and then looked at contract, he said, well, recovery for the purposes of the fee agreement is what I get after the offset.
Okay, let's say that the note had not been accelerated and the plaintiffs recovered the full amount of the jury's verdict.
Yes.
And just continued to pay the note.
Yes.
In the regular course. The attorneys would then be entitled to one-third of the jury's recovery.
Yeah.
And if the client took the $162,000 or whatever it was, damage award, and decided to pay off the mortgage with it, the attorneys would still get the one-third of the $162,000, correct?
Correct.
So what difference does it make that it was an offset?
It applies because essentially the client didn't get all that money. They didn't get the choice. The lawyer didn't put that amount of money in their pocket. Essentially, the lawyer took a fee on losing a significant, in fact, the major part of their client. Now, I mean, what makes it publicly acceptable is that the lawyer creates a fund, and then the lawyer and the client share the fund. What happens here is that the fund isn't created, but the lawyer still takes his fee. It's a little bit like the tax man who says, well, you may not have actually got any income from this, but for tax purposes, your income, you actually did get some.
Well, that happens all the time, doesn't it?
Well, again, that's because the taxing authority writes the law, and they get to do that. But the public is going to become distrustful of contingency fees if what they find out is that for the purposes of the judgment, you get nothing, but for the purposes of calculating the fee, you got something, and you will have to dig into your pocket and pay the attorney money when you got nothing to begin with.
Assuming that's your rule, that it's only the actual cash that the plaintiff receives after a judgment, that's how you calculate the attorney's fees. How would that apply where you don't have this circumstance, where it's the two parties fighting it out, but your client, the plaintiff, files a lawsuit, looks like there's going to be recovery, and then all of a sudden somebody, a total stranger in the transaction, tries to intervene, claiming that there's a debt owed, and they want to attach whatever money is coming out of this, and there's an affiliated lawsuit that goes on. And the trial court doesn't sever the case out. It just has a separate trial on it and ultimately decides, yes, party A is going to have to owe the intervener $30,000. So he transfers funds to the intervener. That reduces the amount of the judgment. The actual cash that gets paid. So the defendant ends up paying two different people. Now, under your scenario, then, the attorney is the one. His fee is only one-third of what the cash recovery is, because that's all that the plaintiff gets.
Well, that actually has two problems, and there's effectively two answers. The first is statutory. Many of the types of liens you're talking about, this is a fight between lien holders. In other words, who gets the money, the attorney or the rival lien holder on the client's claim? In many cases, those are solved by statute. For example, the workers' compensation subrogation lien, there is a provision that solves that problem by saying the claimant's attorney may claim an attorney's fee on what the lien holder gets. So many times that's going to be solved by statutory interpretation. But I think the superior answer is that the lawyer takes
because that is the anticipation that the lawyer's fee will cut into. That's the whole purpose of that statute, is because it recognizes that even though the plaintiff, injured worker, will not get all of the total amount of the damages, the plaintiff's fee will take most of that, and
yeah,
that's why they write the statute to permit the attorney to claim it against the subrogation fund so as not to reduce the workers'
fund. In order to solve that problem. But if we don't have a statute that solves the problem for us, I think the answer is, as the New York case has said in Passaic, the lawyer assumes the risk with his client, and if his client ends up getting nothing because his recovery is seized by an intervening party, then that's just one of the benefits, that's one of the burdens that the lawyer shares with the client. I realize that there's a split in authority outside of Texas, but I think more of the cases that have identified it say if an intervener intervenes to seize the client's recovery, then the lawyer ends up taking his fee only on what's ever left over to the client after the intervener exercises a superior lien. And that's why it's sometimes solved by statute, so that result does not occur. But otherwise, I think the majority rule is the lawyer's recovery rises and falls with the client's recovery.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Jane Weber will present argument for the respondents.
Ms. Weber, what would be wrong with a rule that said, for example, in this case, the attorneys obviously knew this was a case involving that had a mortgage on a house. The attorneys advised the client not to pay, so it was clearly foreseeable that there could easily be a net here, an application of the indebtedness. Why wouldn't it just be easier to require the attorneys to put that in the contract specifically?
Well, I have a couple of responses. First, from a factual standpoint, it's not so. If this court reads the deposition testimony of Ron Levine, it's not so that the lawyer advised him to.
Well, whether they did or didn't, it's clearly foreseeable that there could be an offset.
But from a legal standpoint, what happened here was what you pointed out. They got a benefit. They, in fact, got a benefit. It's not a situation where, it, where say, some other debt, some other thing.
Well, but again, my question is, why not adopt a rule that relies on the literal language of, this, of the contingent fee agreement, which is drawn by the lawyers, when the lawyers could have easily put in there, made it clear that if there was a forgiveness of the indebtedness, that would be a benefit received under the contract?
What this court would then be doing is legislating how private individuals can make their own contracts. Sure, the Hootman case is one way to write a contingency fee contract.
We do that already, though.
Yeah, exactly.
We do that already with regard to unconscionability.
Or fiduciary duties. Right. We construe the agreement against the drafter, especially in a relationship like this, and why shouldn't we do that here when it was clear that the attorneys could have drafted it more clearly in this situation?
Because you can always do that. You can always, with hindsight, redo a contract, rework the language. But in fact here, the language used, talking about a recovery, basing a contingent fee on a recovery, unlike Mr. Hughes's contention, there is not a clear, absolute body of law out there that says recovery can't include some non-cash benefit. In fact, to the contrary, there's abundant law from other states.
But this doesn't say recovery. This says amount received.
Amount received by recovery.
Well, doesn't amount received...
Well, Your Honor, I think some of the cases that are cited in our brief, the Manzo case and the Consolidated Underwriters versus Bradshaw case, both of those cases interpreted language similar to what we've got, and those weren't statutory lien cases like the workers' comp context. Those were cases where private, it was just private parties, common law, where insurance proceeds were used to pay off a mortgage. Exactly the same scenario. The insured plaintiff wins a judgment for $75,000 in insurance proceeds. Only gets cash of $50,000 of it because $25,000 of it goes to pay off a mortgage. Real similar to our scenario. Mortgage is paid off. They've gotten a benefit. They've gotten a recovery. And the courts have held that marginal amount, that $25,000 amount, is subject to the contingent fee analysis.
And what was the contractual language used in that case? Was it amount received, or was it just any recovery?
Well, none of the contracts have exactly, in the many cases that are analyzed, none of them have exactly the same amount. The only cases where the courts very, very strictly construe and say you only get the cash, are ones where the contract said monies received. And, for example, in the Passaic case that Mr. Hughes cited, the Mackey versus Passaic Stone, the contract said monies recovered. And the contract directly reflected the fact that they knew that the counterclaim was coming. In the Mackey case and in the William J. Murphy case, they knew that the counterclaim was coming. In the William J. Murphy case, the client had actually been indicted for the conduct that was leading to the counterclaim.
But clearly, you knew the counterclaim was coming in this case. I mean,
Not necessarily, Your Honor. The facts of the case show that the very shortly after the contingent fee contract was signed, the Smiths sought to accelerate the note. And there was a period of time when Mr. Snell represented the Levines and got a temporary injunction to prevent foreclosure pending the litigation. And during the time that they were not to foreclose on the house, Mr. Snell advised Mr. Levine, and this is what Mr. Levine's deposition testimony says, advised him, don't actually pay the mortgage because we're in litigation right now and we are in under an injunction, but put it in an escrow. Put it in an escrow because we don't know when the injunction situation could end, and we don't know whether we're ultimately going to win. And Mr. Levine took that money and spent it and did not, in fact, put it in an escrow. So the only time that the Levines began the not paying their mortgage was after there was an injunction in place and they defied the specific instructions to keep it in an escrow. And so this is not a situation where we've got a clear understanding in advance that this was coming. And I think that the point is important that if, in fact, it was Mr. Snell's mistake, his misadvice, that that caused it to be accelerated, and that the Levines, if the Levines didn't want to pay their mortgage right now, if they would have preferred to have it go out over time, then they've got a negligence cause of action against Mr. Schnell. They've got a legal malpractice claim against him, and that's the appropriate place to address that. And there's plenty of law in this case, in the state, that says that, that's the kind of thing that you can bring up as a counterclaim in a legal malpractice lawsuit to say, sure, you want this fee, but the advice you gave me was lousy advice. It didn't warrant the fee. You didn't earn it. And they could certainly have done that in this Bexar County case.
Let's say that we determine that the contract, though, is ambiguous. Why shouldn't we construe it against the lawyers who drafted the contract?
Your Honor, I agree that the general rule is that ambiguous contracts are construed against the drafter. However, in this case, there are a couple of hurdles to go through. One substantial procedural hurdle, and then that is that these folks did not plead ambiguity until 4 days out from trial.
Until 4 days when?
4 days from trial.
Before trial?
Yes. The trial was set for September 8th, and on September 4th were the very first time they pleaded ambiguity. The trial court analyzed it and held that Mr. Schnell would be unduly prejudiced by the surprise.
However, a court can always, even on appeal, determine whether or not a contract is ambiguous or not. There's no requirement in Texas law that it be pled.
I believe there is a requirement, Your Honor, that it be pled.
Aren't there cases in the appellate courts of this state where courts in the first instance on appeal have made the determination of whether a contract is ambiguous or not?
Yes, Your Honor, but if the Levines have not pled it, they've not preserved that claim to be able to make that claim to this court.
Well, so a court that is in a position of having to treat a contract as unambiguous when in fact it is an ambiguous contract, then how is a court on appeal supposed to interpret the contract?
Well, Your Honor, it's a question of what is appropriately on the table for this or any other appellate court to review. If there may be things wrong with this judgment, things wrong there that none of us have identified, but our procedural system requires that a party preserve error at each point. If they have not raised a point, have not properly preserved it, it's not before this court.
But it doesn't matter, does it? Because the trial court found it was unambiguous in the law in granting summary judgment. So, again, doesn't that kind of beg the question? I mean, if there had been ambiguity, there would have been a trial, and the trial court granted summary judgment. So it, as a matter of law, found there was not an ambiguity.
Well, the trial court found, as a matter of law, that it was unambiguous, but made that finding in the face of no pleading to the contrary.
Well, but if the trial court found it was unambiguous, and we find that that was error, what then? I mean, again, that's the question.
It's unpreserved error. It is unpreserved error,
and
that happens all the time.
Then you're saying we have to find up here as a matter of law that it was unambiguous because mm-hmm. ambiguity wasn't pled?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that this court needs to find that it is ambiguous, but I believe that it is not preserved for this court to reverse this judgment on the grounds that it is ambiguous.
But we do have to review the trial court's determination. The trial court answered the question, and we have to review that.
Yes, Your Honor.
So how are we going to review it without deciding whether or not the contract is ambiguous or not?
Well, Your Honor, I think this court has to review it within the context of what was presented to the trial court.
So if the trial court made a determination on the question of ambiguity, then why can't we review the question of ambiguity?
Because it's not a matter preserved.
I'm not sure how we're going to review the trial court's determination since we actually have a decision by the trial court. I'm just not understanding your argument. I understand you say it's not preserved, but we actually have a decision by the trial court on the issue that is before us on appeal. So is it your position then that we have to say we refuse to decide whether or not it's ambiguous or not? I mean, I'm not sure what we're supposed to do.
It is a difficult question, and I apologize to the court if it appears like I'm splitting hairs.
Well, I know, but I need some help here because I'm not sure what we're supposed to do then.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that it is a question before this court to make a determination independently of whether or not it is ambiguous or unambiguous because that issue was never appropriately presented
well,
to the trial court and
it's
not preserved.
But I understand your argument that it wasn't presented or preserved, but you agree that the trial court made the determination.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that issue has been challenged on appeal.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the issue is before us. If we say, sorry, you didn't preserve it, therefore we can't do it, then we have to accept what the trial court did as being correct and decide the case on that basis? Is that what you're saying?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I think this court needs to assume that. But I don't think that that presents a real problem here because this is an unambiguous contract. This isn't a case of a latent ambiguity, Justice Enoch, like you were talking about earlier.
It isn't.
It is not a case of a latent ambiguity because
well, they recovered a free house.
Exactly. They got a house.
But they look at exactly the same language in the contract and say, wait a minute, this says an amount recovered. And we didn't recover any amounts.
Just because two parties have different contentions of what language means doesn't make it ambiguous. If I represent a client and I win a declaratory judgment that they own 100,000 shares of Dell stock, they have absolutely gotten a recovery. And I'm absolutely entitled to some value for that, fee for that. And from a policy...
But you've got cases in different states using, as you say, similar language. And some go one way and some go... So you got judges who are looking at the contract, not the parties, and judges are saying, well, nope, this obviously means property that's recovered, and others say, no, it means cash.
You know, Your Honor, if you go through the cases that the Levines cite on this point, saying that set off just, it's a majority rule, set off just, you just don't get any money for it. Every single one of those cases where the fee was not allowed on the set off amount, every single one of those cases was either interpretation of language of something like monies received or funds received, where it's clear that you're limited to cash.
That includes Missouri?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't know offhand which one is in Missouri.
I think Missouri's contract had a mail.
Kramer versus Fallot.
But all of them were either monies received or were instances where the set off wasn't in fact a benefit, a recovery for the plaintiff. For example,
I'm missing something here. The Smith's counterclaim was to recover the unpaid balance of the mortgage existing against the Levine's home, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And they were successful?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the recovery by the Levine's as plaintiffs was offset by the mortgage amount. So they paid it.
But what they recovered was a free and clear title to their house.
But they paid $120,000 for whatever that...
They paid
$136,000, and so the mortgage goes away.
Yes, Your Honor.
But it's offset.
Yes, Your Honor.
And granted, they're still in the house, but they were in the house anyway.
But the lien is gone, and that is a benefit. My mortgage
can
be paid till I'm 50.
Because the offset amount paid the lien.
Yes, Your Honor. But that is a benefit to them. What happened is the jury awarded $243,000 to the Levines,
yes,
and then said the mortgage that's left is $161,000. So the decree portion of the judgment said, Levines, you get
net
$81,000 cash plus, and this is in the decree portion of the judgment, you get all liens released on your house.
Why shouldn't you? They paid it.
Exactly. And they got that. But they got
now,
that
now
from
let's go
the
to
Smiths.
A separate thing of the contract, which you say is unambiguous. And let's agree with that because that's what the trial court found. But the parties construe it differently. Can't we just look at it and decide which side we believe is correctly looking at that language?
Well,
without regard to any extrinsic evidence.
Well, I think that's the appropriate thing to do, Your Honor.
So we could decide, well, the Mackey-Kramer line cases is the better way to go, and we'll construe it what it says to mean net, and so no more fees are owed.
That is one decision this court could make, but I submit that would be an incorrect and inappropriate decision for a couple of reasons. One is, and I think several members of this court in questions earlier have recognized, this is some benefit. This is a value to have your mortgage paid off. You own your house.
Well, I don't think anybody disagrees with that. But you can say that the way the claim and counterclaim came out, that by the exchange of the claim for the set-off, that's out, that it's gone. But they still didn't get $243,000 cash to base the fee on.
Well, they didn't get $243,000 cash in their pockets. Mm-hmm. What they got was a portion of $243,000 cash in their pockets and a portion of $243,000 that paid off a debt that gave them a direct benefit.
Okay,
and
I understand your argument.
And but from a policy standpoint, I think it would be an unwise decision to say that a benefit like that the recovery of this title is absolutely by God not going to be subject to a contingent fee because we're only going to look at cash. For example, right now
there's one other thing that disturbed me. Do I understand that part of the recovery requested by your client is the entire $60,000 fee awarded as a separate amount?
Yes, Your Honor, that is an express term in the fee contract. It says specifically that in addition to the one-third contingent fee,
well,
how then
do you work the figures when at least the way they're stacked up shows an offset of attorney's fees against attorney's fees when you net it out?
Well, Your Honor, if I understand your question correctly, first of all, it's not attorney's fees on attorney's fees because the one-third was calculated taking out the $60,000 court-awarded attorney's fees. So the one-third was calculated on 180, which was the 243 less the $60,000. So Mr. Levine, Mr. Snell's fee was not calculated of attorney's fees on attorney's fees, a contingent fee on the contingent fee. It was calculated on a third of the net, and then the $60,000 was added back in, and so that comes out to the total of 120 plus interest. But that is an express term of the contract, and it is no different from the analysis of the contingent fee. It was no more set off and eliminated than any of the dollars were, because they received it in another
didn't
form.
Didn't it result in more than a 50% fee?
No, Your Honor, it results in exactly a 50% fee. In fact, a little bit less than 50% in this case. The total amount of the fee was $120,000 and a little bit, and the total amount of the verdict was $243,000. So it's a little bit less than 50%.
How about your claim for interest?
Excuse me?
Then you got a claim for
20-something thousand for interest, calculated at it's calculated at 10%, interest calculated at 10%, and it's about almost a three-year period.
But your client wasn't recovering interest, was he?
Interest accrued on everything. Interest accrued on the cash net portion that the Smiths had to pay the Levines, and interest accrued on the fee that the Levines owed to Mr. Smith. Now, where interest did not accrue was on the other recovery, getting the lien dismissed. The day of judgment, they had that one. The day of judgment, they owned the house free and clear, unlike the cash portion, which they didn't actually get to check until all appeals were resolved. But Justice Baker, going back to the issue of getting the contingent fee and also getting the court-awarded attorney's fees, that is expressed in the contract. The contingent fee agreement stays a third. It doesn't stair-step up through appeals when many, many contracts do, many contingent fee contracts do.
Well, it stays
a third.
So be that.
Well, and that's why it doesn't ever get above a 50%. In this case, it would be much less.
You charge expenses, too.
Reimbursement for expenses, but that comes off the top. That doesn't just come out of the client's portion. That comes off the top.
From a policy standpoint and from a perception standpoint, isn't this case a poster child of why the public has a high disregard for lawyers in the legal profession?
I disagree, Your Honor. I absolutely disagree.
Why?
What Mr. Snell did was represent the Levines through a very difficult trial, a very difficult appeal, all the way through motions for rehearing to this court, secured for them recovery of a full, clear title to their house, plus cash that went towards paying his fee. And what he recovered was a portion of what he won for them in the trial court. I submit that it would be very poor policy for this court to say, we're going to ignore benefits and recoveries that lawyers win for their clients in hard-fought fights. The loser in that one, as I think Chief Justice Phillips said earlier, the loser in that one is the clients. What lawyer is going to take a contingent fee case in the future if you cannot collect a fee on anything other than cash in your
pocket? But you could still do it. You just put it in the contract. You specify exactly so the client understands what the recovery is going to be. I mean, that's an easy one to get around, isn't it? Just to make it specific in the agreement.
Your Honor, I think that the term recovery covers this. I think the term recovery absolutely addresses this.
Would your argument be the same if rather than the offset being to pay off a mortgage, the offset was to pay off a defamation counterclaim, and there was some suit for money with damages that had to be calculated by a finder of fact after evidence? Would you make the same type of argument? They got a benefit.
I think it would depend on the relationship. It would necessarily depend on the subject matter of the counterclaim, the relationship between the main claim and the counterclaim. For example, no question, I think comparative negligence. You're not going to get a reduction of a plaintiff's recovery because of comparative negligence. Not going to get it. Also, there's one of the cases cited. The William J. Murphy case, it was a suit for breach of contract for non-payment, and the counterclaim was for overbilling on that contract. I think in a situation like that, the relationship of those claims is such that it's not truly a benefit received, and those would be areas that. In some situations it would be appropriate, in some situations it would not. Here we don't have any gray. We've got a house that's paid off. And I think that if this court determines that you just can't recover a contingent fee on that kind of benefit received, from a policy standpoint, what that would do would be discourage any sort of creative or alternative means of settlement.
I'm not saying you can't do that. I'm saying you need a contract.
Well, if you have a situation like ours where the contract calls for a third of recovery and you say, sorry, that only means cash that you get in your pocket. Let's say these folks went into mediation. Rather than trying the case, the Smiths and the Levines went into mediation. And at mediation, they worked out an agreement whereby to resolve the DTPA disputes, the Smiths would agree to reduce the mortgage, to wipe out, say, go from 160 on the mortgage to 100,000, and that would reduce the monthly payments on the mortgage, and that would allow the Levines to have some extra money with which they could pay the foundation damage that was at the subject, the heart of the whole dispute. Under the Levines analysis, the lawyer gets zero for that. But isn't that a good result? Isn't that a result that we want to encourage litigants to be able to work together to try to achieve creative and independent resolutions? And I submit to this court that a narrow construction, that saying anything other than recovery plus other things that you got to benefits, any tangible benefits, would discourage any of that sort of creative thinking.
Well, on the other hand, though, Ms. Weber, if you're talking about if a client's perspective is that I'm going to turn over a percentage of the amount of money I receive, so I'm comfortable signing this contract. But if the client's not prepared under your scenario, the client's done a contingent fee contract because the client doesn't have the cash to pay a lawyer. And so now they've received a benefit that's not going to put cash in their pocket. At the same time, they receive, under your scenario, a $20,000 attorney's fees bill that they can't pay. So isn't it important, then, for the contract to be clear that, in fact, you're not just talking about cash that's recovered, but all benefit, so that a client does not find themselves in the position of getting a bill for an attorney's fee where they have to write a cash that they may not be in a position to be able to pay. I mean, the usual scenario on the contingent fee is that money's going to change hands and you can have a piece of it. I don't have to worry about the fact that do I have this money over here in my savings account to pay you. If you start getting into benefits that are not cash benefits, don't we put clients in a position, if it's not clear to them at the beginning, when they're expecting not to come out of pocket for anything, to find themselves in that position? Isn't that a problem for clients?
Your Honor, that could be a problem for clients. That could be a difficulty for clients. And I think in this situation, what the record establishes is that Mr. Snell worked with the Levines on that. But from a legal standpoint...
I understand that, but I'm just talking about your scenario about the mediation. I might not be able to settle my claim if I didn't realize it beforehand that I might have to come out of pocket for $20,000. The reason why I did the contingent fee in the first place is because I couldn't afford to pay a lawyer.
Your Honor, I think that those are, on the front end, I think recovery is a clear term that's defined in the law, and I think all of y'all perceive.
Well, you keep focusing on recovery, and you're ignoring amount received. And I'm having a hard time distinguishing between monies received and amount received.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the contract uses both the terms recovery and amount received, but also amount and money are...
Same thing.
I don't believe they're the same thing, Your Honor, but the fee contract uses both the terms recovery and amount received. I submit that it's an appropriate term to use. But under your scenario, Justice Hankinson, yes, I think there could be situations where a client could be surprised. But just because you didn't analyze, just because two different folks have different interpretations of what language means doesn't...
The two different folks have interpretations, and one of them is a fiduciary and is the draft. Why did the contingent fee in the first place? It's because I couldn't afford to pay a lawyer.
Your Honor, I think that those are, on the front end, I think recovery is a clear term that's defined in the law, and I think all of y'all perceive.
Well, you keep focusing on recovery, and you're ignoring amount received. And I'm having a hard time distinguishing between monies received and amount received.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the contract uses both the terms recovery and amount received, but also amount and money are...
Same thing.
I don't believe they're the same thing, Your Honor, but the fee contract uses both the terms recovery and amount received. I submit that it's an appropriate term to use. But under your scenario, Justice Hankinson, yes, I think there could be situations where a client could be surprised. But just because you didn't analyze, just because two different folks have different interpretations of what language means doesn't...
The two different folks have interpretations, and one of them is a fiduciary and is the drafter of the contract in that way. So doesn't this all then weigh in favor of what Justice Gonzalez says, that if we're going to have this kind of situation, we should be perfectly clear in the contract from the front, and so that there aren't any surprises for the client?
But how do you know it's coming? How do you know it's coming? How can you do that? How can you contract for every eventuality?
But it's hard to imagine anything more clear than a situation like this, that a counterclaim is coming for the mortgage. I mean, I can understand scenarios where something could come out of the blue, but this doesn't strike me as one.
There is no evidence in the record to establish that...
Just as a matter of common sense, if you're going to sue for foundation damage, isn't it foreseeable you're going to get a counterclaim to recover the mortgage?
It could happen, but not necessarily so. If you're current on your mortgage and you keep paying it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
There is a...
Mr. Hughes, I'm sorry.
Certain.
Whose money did the Levines use to pay off the mortgage?
They didn't use any money. I mean...
Well, their mortgage got paid off, so somebody paid. So whose money did they use to pay that?
Well, I guess in the same sense that the Smiths might say, I wonder if my how did I recover anything on the mortgage? It just, they both were extinguished. I mean, that's the effect of the asset.
But it wasn't extinguished. It was paid off. You say extinguished, but it was paid off. And whose money paid it off?
Well, two things. First, I disagree. Under offset law, they're just extinguished. Both sides' debts are extinguished, period. They're treated as not existing. There's not the theoretical thing of the money being paid to the Levines, who then pay it back to the Smiths. The court short-circuits that and says nobody owes anybody on that.
That's what makes it critical. That's why it's critical to your argument, that there can't have been an exchange of funds here, because otherwise that affects recovery. So is it critical to you that we determine that there has not been an exchange of funds here in order for you to win on your argument that there was no recovery the 200?
I think it is because, the number one, the majority rule is that you calculate the recovery, absent language to the contrary, you calculate recovery on the net after applying an offset. So it's important to mind our analysis that an offset was applied.
Did the Smiths receive any money?
No. And maybe to take that question one step further, under Justice O'Neill's hypothetical, let's suppose a complete offset. Nobody pays anything because my damages equal your damages. And let's take it one step further. Let's suppose the Smiths' attorney had a contingent fee because he thought he was going to beat the other side and recover $160,000 cash. Well, then, if you accept the respondent's argument under that hypothetical, both attorneys get paid a contingent fee for losing the case. The Smith's attorney would get one-fifth because he recovered the amount on the mortgage. You just unfortunately didn't get it because you had to pay the other side's damages. And then we'd hear the attorney firm on the other side saying, well, gee, you made a recovery because you got a benefit, and I get one-third of that benefit. And so both attorneys get paid for losing the case, and I don't think that's what the public expects from us.
Let me ask you about another provision of the agreement.
Yes.
The second part of the main sentence, to receive such payments, client assigns to attorney 33 1/3% undivided interest in his cause of action.
Yes.
Wouldn't that be gross?
No, because it refers to payments. It says to secure the payments.
Well, but 33 1/3 undivided interest in the cause of action is the gross. It's not set off by the counterclaim.
I think, once again, if you say cause of action, you're meaning damages, and if the damages, the only damage recovery that's part of the cause of action is what's left over afterwards, that would not be the gross. And it starts off to secure such payments. In other words, to make it legal under the code, and I'm not sure this language would pass by the model rules, the interest is assigned only to the extent necessary to secure the payment of the fee. In other words,
I understand that, but you can read the front part to limit the back part, or you can read the back part to expand the front part, and I'm asking.
Well, I think you have to harmonize them.
Well, if he was getting a third of the cause of action, and they both thought that was the gross, it would indicate that they thought the payments were going to be on the gross.
Well, the language is drawn not to transfer a flat one-third of the cause of action. It says to convey that part to cover the payment. In other words, it secures only the payment. And the payment modifies the part amount received.
So it might be less than a third of the cause of
action? Yes. In other words, It exists only to the extent necessary to secure the payment, which refers then to the amount received. In other words, it's saying the amount received is essentially a payment, and I think that shores up to show why amount received refers net, because that's the only way it can be a payment. And then the interest conveyed only secures their fee interest in the amount received, that is, the payment to the client. Also, I want... My time has expired.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the arguments for today. The marshal will now adjourn the court.